Welcome to the New Life Podcast, a ministry of New Life Presbyterian Church in Ithaca, New York. Today we have this week's sermon preached by Tim LaCroix, our senior pastor. Join us for worship each week at 10 o'clock at 950 Danby Road, Ithaca, New York. You can also visit us on our website, www.newlifeithaca.org. Now here's this week's sermon.
A reading from the book of Ruth, chapter 1, verses 1 through 17. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech. His wife's name was Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah. And they went to Moab and lived there. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. After they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. When Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, she and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." Then she kissed them goodbye, and they wept aloud, and said to her, "We will go back with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband, even if I thought there was still hope for me. Even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters. It is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has turned against me." At this they wept aloud again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. "Look," said Naomi, "your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her." But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me." This is the word of the Lord.
A reading of the verses from the Holy Gospel of St. Matthew, chapter 1. Please stand if you are able. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, and Salmon the father of Boaz by Rahab, and Boaz the father of Obed by Ruth, and Obed the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of David the king. And David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah, and Solomon the father of Rehoboam, and Rehoboam the father of Abijah, and Abijah the father of Asaph, and Asaph the father of Jehoshaphat, and Jehoshaphat the father of Joram, and Joram the father of Uzziah, and Uzziah the father of Jotham, and Jotham the father of Ahaz, and Ahaz the father of Hezekiah, and Hezekiah the father of Manasseh, and Manasseh the father of Amos, and Amos the father of Josiah, and Josiah the father of Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the deportation to Babylon. And after the deportation to Babylon, Jeconiah was the father of Shealtiel, and Shealtiel the father of Zerubbabel, and Jacob the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born, who is called Christ. So all the generations from Abraham to David were 14 generations, and from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations, and from the deportation to Babylon to the Christ, 14 generations.
This past week, a woman was extradited from France back to the United States. Her crime was stowing away on a flight from JFK to Paris. How she managed to do this was quite interesting. It was not the case that she had a ticket for another flight and then absconded onto a different one. She didn't have a ticket at all. So her first feat had to be that she snuck through TSA, got through security at JFK. She tried first to go the normal route up to the main line and up to the where they check your ID, and she was turned away because she didn't have a ticket. But then she tried again. She went to the employee entrance and hid herself amongst some other people going through, other flight attendants and pilots and such, and she was able to get past the first check, and she actually went through security. She went through the magnetometer and all that. She made her way to the gate, and amidst the hubbub and chaos of Thanksgiving, she managed to slip past the gate agents onto the plane. Somebody was no doubt trying to get their stroller gate checked with a screaming toddler beside them. She made her way onto the plane and was not detected until the plane was landing in Paris. She managed to stow away by going from bathroom to bathroom, basically moving about the plane during the flight, which must have been about, 6-7 hours from JFK to Paris? She was only discovered when the plane was about to land and everyone was supposed to return to their seats, and one of the flight attendants discovered that the bathroom was occupied. She was asked to provide her ticket. She could not provide one, and so she was found out. I don't know exactly what she planned to do when she landed, how she was going to get through border security, customs and all that, but given the fact that she made it that far, I wouldn't put it past her getting all the way through. All of this reminded me of the story of Frank Abagnale. I don't know if you've heard of the story of Frank Abagnale, but Frank Abagnale's life was the basis for a movie called Catch Me If You Can. Frank was played by the actor Leonardo DiCaprio, and his father was played by Christopher Walken. Love interest was Amy Adams, and the detective that was searching for him for several years was Detective Henretty, played by none other than Tom Hanks. And the story of Frank Abagnale is that he also was from New York, New Rochelle, New York, and from when he was a teenager, he began sneaking onto airplanes and riding. He posed as an airline pilot. He learned the jargon of airline pilots. He got himself a uniform and basically stowed away on airplanes by posing as a pilot from another airline and sitting in the jump seat of the cockpit. He did this for several years, and he never got caught. He began to up his con by beginning to forge checks. He got hold of a printer that prints checks, the little funny-looking numbers at the bottom of checks as a routing number and the account numbers, and he began to forge checks and forged millions of dollars of checks. At one point, he posed as a doctor in Florida and became the director of the emergency room at a hospital in Florida. When he was found out and was about to be arrested, he stole off to Louisiana, where he posed as a law student and actually passed the bar without going to law school and was about to marry the daughter of a judge there before he was found out. They finally got him in France, coincidentally, New York and France, isn't that interesting, where he was still running away. So Frank Abagnale and Svetlana Hadid, two notorious stowaways. In the text today, we find another stowaway. We find somebody who's not supposed to be here. We find somebody who makes her way in by blending in with those who are supposed to be there. And so the question for us today is, this stowaway, what's going to happen when she gets caught? Is she going to be deported? Is she going to be extradited back to the land where she is from? How will she be received as a stowaway in God's land? This is the second Sunday of Advent, and as we've been talking about, Advent is a season to prepare, to consider the brokenness of this world and to cry out and long for something better. The quote that I've read to you already a couple times already from Fleming Rutledge, Advent is a time to take a fearless inventory of darkness. The darkness and brokenness of this world, to look right in the face of the problem and the pain and the suffering that is all around us. And as we look at that, we're not doing it in a sort of way to punish ourselves. We're doing it in order that we may be realistic about the world we live in and to cry out to God to fix it. Cry out to God to save us. And so the season of Advent is a season of longing. It is a season of hope and expectation. And it is a season to cry out for God to come and deliver us. And so as we move along in our weeks toward weeks of Advent, we are moving closer and closer to the answer of our prayers. And we begin singing more about the answer to our prayers and talking more about the birth of Christ, which is, of course, the first advent of Christ, which is the answer to the prayers that we are praying. This is God's answer for the problems that we see in the world, is for his Son to become one of us, to become incarnate and come into our world. We've been going through a series called The Mothers of Jesus. Last week, we looked at Rahab. This week, we are looking at Ruth. These are called the mothers of Jesus because, as we read in the Gospel of Matthew, there are four women mentioned in this genealogy in pretty quick succession. These women all have a lot in common. As we talked about last week, there are all four of these women are foreigners, right? Rahab and Tamar and Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah the Hittite, are Canaanites. They are from the Canaanite peoples. And so they are pagan foreigners. Ruth here is a foreigner too, but she is actually of the Semitic line, a descendant of Eber, technically a Hebrew. The Moabites were descended from Lot, as Lot was Abraham's nephew. And you can read the story after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, how Lot's wife died because she looked back. She longed to go back to Sodom and Gomorrah, and she was turned into a pillar of salt. Then his daughters took it upon themselves to have children by their father, and that's how Moab and Ammon came to be. So although Ruth is of the sort of family, extended family of God's people, she comes from a nation of people that has a pretty shameful beginning. And the story of the people that we read all throughout this genealogy is a pretty broken and messed up family. The story of Tamar, the story of Rahab, the story of Bathsheba, whose husband was murdered by David and was taken advantage of by him, and somehow God redeemed that relationship. And so what we see in this genealogy is that there are mothers of Christ that are not the way we would expect the genealogy of Christ to be. And Matthew is the only one who inserts these names into the list. Matthew is the only one who inserts Ruth's name or Rahab's name into the list of genealogy. Why does he do that? Perhaps as a tax collector, he wants to emphasize the fact that God brings in sinners into his family. And God brings in all sorts of people, Matthew being one who was also looked down upon because of his profession and because of his sinful life. Today we come to Ruth, and Ruth is a person, a story that is revealed in the Christian scriptures. As we come to Ruth, we're gonna take a look at all four chapters of Ruth, not in any detail. We're gonna basically take a survey of this book. But Ruth is the story of Ruth breaks down. I'm gonna break it down into three points today. And the first point is this. The Redeemer shows kindness to stowaways. The Redeemer shows kindness to stowaways. Here we have a stowaway. As we look at chapter 1, we find the story of a man named Elimelech. Elimelech is married to a woman named Naomi. Elimelech means "my God is king." Naomi's name means "pleasant." She later changes that to "bitter" because she's bitter at her fortune, her providence. So there was a famine in the land, and Elimelech decided to leave the land and go outside the land to the nation and the country of Moab. This is sort of a reverse exodus. They're going out, they're crossing the Jordan River, going back out. But perhaps an allusion to the story of Jacob, who because of a famine in the land went down into Egypt. But the opposite occurs, whereas Jacob left empty and came back full, with all sorts of people, many, many hundreds of thousands of people. Elimelech went out full and came back empty. While they were in Moab, he died. His two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, died. They had taken Moabite wives, and so Naomi is left without her husband, without her sons, and two foreign daughters-in-law. Naomi hears that the Lord has visited the people of Israel and blessed them with food. In other words, the famine is over. So she decides she has nothing left. She's just going to go back home. As her and her daughters-in-law are traveling back, she realizes this doesn't make any sense. This doesn't make any sense for Naomi to go with me, for these two women to go with me. And so she tells them to go back. Ruth decides to go on. She decides to cling to her mother-in-law and to come on as a stowaway into the people of Israel. And so the question is, how does Israel receive stowaways? How does Israel receive people who don't belong there? What we see very clearly in chapter 2 of Ruth is that the Redeemer visits the stowaways with kindness. We find in the story of chapter 2 of Ruth that Ruth says she's going to go glean in the fields, and she's going to go amongst the reapers and pick grain that is left behind. And we see the Redeemer, Boaz, who we find later in the story, is a close relative, which in Hebrew would be called a kinsman redeemer. We find the Redeemer showing her kindness, even though she is from Moab, again, a shameful people. We find in the story that he tells his workers not to prevent her from gleaning, and in fact to provide her even more. Now, why do you think that Boaz was willing to treat a foreigner in such a way? Well, one of the reasons is because this was according to God's law. It was actually God's law that foreigners and strangers be treated this way. We find in four different places in Leviticus and Deuteronomy this is emphasized. In Leviticus 23, chapter 23, verse 22, it says, "When you reap the harvest of your land, moreover, you shall not reap to the very corners of your field, nor gather the gleaning of your harvest." In other words, the stuff that is left on the ground, you shouldn't go back. You should leave it there. "You are to leave them for the needy and the alien. I am the Lord your God." What's interesting there is the reason why they are to leave behind food for the needy and for the foreigner is because he's the Lord. That's the reason, because I am the Lord your God. It shows us that he cares. He cares for strangers. He cares for foreigners. He cares for people who are different. He shows kindness to the stowaways. Leviticus 19, verse 9, very similar verse. He says, "Now when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap to the very corners of your field, neither shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest." Again, in Deuteronomy 24, 19, this is Moses recapping what the Lord said in Leviticus. "When you reap your harvest in your field," and this is interesting, "you have forgotten a sheaf in the field." In other words, they got back home and they're counting the bundles of barley, and they count up and they count 19, and the manager says, "Wait, we had 20. We left one behind." He says, "Don't go back and get it. Leave that left behind sheaf. It shall be for the alien, for the orphan, and the widow, in order that the Lord your God may bless you in the work of your hands." In Leviticus 19:10, it says, "Nor shall you glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather the fallen fruit of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the needy and the stranger, for I am the Lord your God." Even the poor people deserve to have a little bit of wine, as it says in Proverbs 31, to give wine and strong drink to those who are perishing. What is all this about? What does this mean? It means that according to God's law, we are not to wring every little bit of profit out of the system, but we are to be generous. You know, it would make sense for the farmer to maximize his profit by getting everything he can out of the land, by picking up the pieces that have fallen on the ground, by maximizing the potential of his produce. But the Lord says, no, do not do that. You are to leave the leftovers, you are to leave the gleanings for those who have not, especially those who are strangers and foreigners in the land. And so this is what we find Boaz doing. We find Boaz showing Ruth kindness. We find him saying to his workers that they are to leave a little bit extra so that she can get even more. We find him protecting her and saying, "Stay with my young women so that you can be protected in this place where she was very vulnerable." The Lord shows kindness to the stowaways. And so we see that the Lord shows kindness to us. The Redeemer shows kindness to us. There's this thing called imposter syndrome. You ever heard of imposter syndrome? It's where people feel like they don't belong. They don't measure up. In fact, very successful and smart people can feel this. I don't know if you've ever felt it. You be in a room of people or be in a place where there's a lot of successful people, smart people, and you absolutely deserve to be there, but you feel like you're an imposter. I wonder if we feel like we're imposters in God's house. I wonder if you've ever felt in God's house like, I don't belong here. I'm not good enough to be here. Well, the Lord says that you are good enough to be here. You do belong here, because those that are stowaways, those that are strangers, are shown kindness in God's house. He loves the foreigner. He loves the widow. He loves the needy. He loves the stranger. He wants you to sneak in and stow away on his plane. This is the kindness that the Redeemer shows. And so not only should we take comfort in knowing that we belong, we should also extend that kindness to others. We should extend the kindness of the Lord to those who are strangers, those who are needy, because this is what the Lord has done for us. The reason why they were not to glean to the corners of their field was because the Lord said, you were once a foreigner in Egypt. You were once a stranger and alien. And so we find all through the law that they are to treat foreigners and strangers and aliens with kindness, because you were once that. And the lesson for us is, although we would consider ourselves to be insiders and those who come into our presence to be outsiders or stowaways, the answer is that we're all stowaways. None of us belong. We have all hitched a ride by trying to go from bathroom to bathroom on the flight to Paris. None of us belong here. We're all stowaways, and God welcomes us all. There is nobody who belongs to be here. There was no one who deserves to be here, and God shows his kindness to all of us. The second thing we see is that the Redeemer welcomes the stowaway into his family. We find this mostly in chapter 4 of Ruth. Not only does he show kindness to Ruth, not only does he allow her to pick up the pieces that were left over, not only does he offer her protection, but he offers to redeem her. He offers, in fact, to bring her into his family. What we find out in this story is that Naomi, when Ruth goes back to tell Naomi about her day and how she gleaned and she worked very hard, and she wasn't given the sheaves. She had to go glean them. She had to thresh them. She had to produce. So she had to work very hard. When she went home at the end of the day, she talked to her mother-in-law, and she asked her what field she gleaned in. And Ruth said, Boaz was his name. And Naomi said, he is a close relative of ours. He is one of our redeemers. Now, what does this mean? The word redeemer in this context refers to a close relative. That if your husband dies or your father dies and you're left, if a family is left without any offspring or without any, frankly, in this society and culture, without any male in the household, it was the possibility that the closest relative to them would have the opportunity to purchase the land, to be an inheritance for their family, to produce an inheritance for a family that would have none. And if it worked out, if the person was not already married, they could also marry the widow and bring her into the family and produce heirs for the dead. This was the accommodation that was made in God's law to make sure that every family continued to be a part of the lineage of the Messiah. And so Naomi knows that Boaz is one of her close redeemers. And so she instructs Ruth to go and to present herself before Boaz, and this is what we see in chapter 3. But ultimately what we find is that Boaz agrees that he's going to redeem their family. He's going to try to purchase the land. This will give Naomi and Ruth finances to be independent, so they can provide for themselves. He will purchase their land as an inheritance, and he also wants to marry Ruth. But before he's able to do this, he has to go and get to make sure that, because there is another redeemer who was a closer relation. So part of chapter 4 is Boaz going before the city elders and asking the closer redeemer if it is okay if he redeems the property and marries Ruth. And what I find interesting in this story is the fact that the closest redeemer, there is a redeemer that's closer to Ruth and Naomi than Boaz. And what's fascinating about the genealogy of Jesus as Ryan was so adeptly reading all those names, one of the commentators, Matthew Henry, and other commentators have pointed out that most of the people in the genealogy of Christ are not the firstborn. In other words, they're not the closest redeemer. Most of the people in this genealogy are the secondborn, or even the lastborn. David was the lastborn son. The people in this genealogy are foreigners, and a lot of them have a great amount of sin and brokenness in their lives. And so they're not the closest redeemer. Jesus was not the closest redeemer. There were other redeemers who were of the line of the kings that were technically closer to the line of Messiah. And what I think this is pulling out for us to consider is that there are things in our life that may be closer redeemers for us. There may be things in our life which look like the answer for us. You know, we may look at our problems, we may look at our situation, and the closest redeemer may look like financial success. That may look like the way that we can get out of our situation. It may look like academic success. It may look like any number of things that we look to bring us either help or salvation or get us out of our troubles, or the things that we may turn to in order to soothe ourselves. They may look like a closer redeemer to us. But in fact, those redeemers are not willing to redeem us. What the story reveals is the closest redeemer to Ruth and Naomi is not willing to do it. He is not willing to give up his inheritance. He is not willing to give up his stake in order to make the sacrifice to redeem them. And so these closer redeemers, although they may look promising, they may look powerful, they may look like they can offer us a way out, they are not willing to redeem you. They are not going to redeem you. They are not going to save you. The closest ones, the ones that look obvious to us, are not the ones that will save. There is a very close redeemer, though, who is willing to redeem us, and his name is Jesus. Boaz is a close redeemer, but he is not the closest. Isn't it the case that many of the things that we run to that we call idols, and we talked about this before, an idol is a good thing turned into an ultimate thing. In other words, it's a close redeemer. The relation between the good things and the ultimate things is close. But when we take those closer redeemers who were not willing to redeem us and are not willing to, and cannot redeem us, and turn to them, we are turning to things that will never, ever satisfy. The redeemer who is not the closest but is willing has done the redemptive work. And we see in the story that Boaz is willing to do it. And another thing that's interesting is that the name of the closest redeemer is not mentioned. His name is not mentioned. In the text in Ruth chapter 4, it calls him friend. And the Hebrew is, I think it's alomi palomi or something like that, which is you so-and-so. They didn't mention his name because if it would be discovered that he refused to redeem Ruth, to redeem Naomi, it would bring everlasting shame upon his family. So they took the name out so as not to bring shame on this family. Because the fact that he was not willing to redeem was shameful. But Boaz was willing to do it, and he did it. He brings the stowaway into his family. So it's not only the case that God shows kindness to us as stowaways, it's not only the case that he provides for us as stowaways. He wants us to be a part of his family. He brings this Moabitess who has been married before. And I find it fascinating also that as we look at the genealogy, we see that the four women that are mentioned, none of them are virgins, right? Rahab is not a virgin. Tamar is not. Ruth has been married before. Bathsheba was married before. We get to the end of the genealogy and we find the Virgin Mary. And I've talked about this before, and I'll talk about it again probably on the fourth week of Advent. But Mary wasn't a virgin because virginity was something that you needed to have in order to be a mother of Jesus. She was a virgin because it had to be able to be proven that she indeed was conceived of by the Holy Spirit. In other words, these ladies who are in the line of Christ, they are redeemed by God and they are sanctified by the blood of Christ and by the Spirit, and that makes them worthy to be mothers of Jesus. Not some supposed purity test. And I think that's interesting. All four of these women, none of them were, they were sketchy. All four were sketchy and they had sketchy pasts. So we see that the Redeemer shows kindness to the stowaway. We see that the Redeemer brings the stowaway into his family. And lastly, we see that the stowaway, Ruth, is saved by faith. She's saved by faith. This is the beauty of the end of chapter 1. It couldn't be any clearer that Ruth is saved by faith, and this whole redemption story is because of her faith in God. We read this part. We get to the end where Naomi says to her two daughters-in-law, I want you to go back. There's nothing for you here. I can't give you sons. You're going to be foreigners. You're not going to be accepted in this place. You might as well go back to your father's house. You might as well try to marry someone else and live in your own land and go back to your gods. Orpah cried and she kissed Naomi and left. But Ruth refused. Ruth refused. And her statement of faith is one of the clearest and most beautiful creedal statements that we could have. The Ruthian creed. She says to Naomi, do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. And here's the creed. For where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. And may the Lord do so to me and more, if anything but death parts me from you. Ruth was saved by faith. She clings to Naomi, and she confesses that she will worship the God of Israel. And it is this faith which saves her. And I want to point out that there is no rational reason. I know that's redundant, but there's no rational explanation for why Ruth would do this. It makes complete sense that she would go back to her father's house. It makes complete sense that she would go back to her own land where she had a possibility of success in a future. It makes no sense that she would cling to Naomi and go to a foreign place. There's no rationality to it at all. This is faith. Her heart was changed, her life was changed, and she clings. She clings to Naomi, and she is redeemed because of her faith. And indeed, Boaz sees her faith, and he sees the kindness that she has shown to Naomi, and it's one of the reasons why he is drawn to her and marries her. The people of the Old Testament were saved by faith, and Ruth's faith puts her into the hall of faith. In Hebrews chapter 11, we see what we call the hall of faith. All the folks of the Old Testament who had this faith, the faith of Ruth. Ruth was very similar to Abraham. Abraham was someone who left his father's house and left his own country to the land that God would show. And Ruth does the very same thing. And what we see that in Hebrews chapter 11 is all the people who were saved by faith in the Old Testament. We see that Abel was saved by faith. And we see that Enoch was saved by faith. And the writer says that Noah was saved by faith. And Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out of the place that he was born by faith. And Sarah, by faith, conceived of Isaac. And the writer says these all died in faith, never having received the promise of the things that they believed in. They were strangers and exiles on the earth. But he continues along the list of the hall of faith. He says Isaac was saved by faith. And he says that Jacob was saved by faith. And he says that Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because of their faith. And then Moses refused. He considered the reproach of Christ greater than the wealth of the treasures of Egypt, but he was looking for the reward of Christ. By faith, he left Egypt. By faith, he kept the Passover and sprinkled the blood. By faith, the people of Israel crossed the Red Sea. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell. By faith, Rahab the prostitute did not perish, but hid the spies. And what more shall I say, he says. For time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah and David and Samuel and the prophets who through faith conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, were made strong out of weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received back their dead by resurrection. Some were tortured, refusing to accept release so that they might rise again to a better life. Others suffered mocking and flogging and chains and imprisonment. They were stoned and sawn in two. They were killed with the sword. They went about in skins of sheep and goats, destitute, afflicted, and mistreated, of whom the world was not worthy, wandering about in deserts and mountains and dens and caves of the earth. All these, though commended through their faith, did not receive what was promised, since God had provided something better for us, that apart from us, they should not be made perfect. Therefore, he says, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, by Ruth and Rahab and all the rest, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and the perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. This is our Redeemer. This is the one who bought us back. This is the one who paid the price. This is the one who shows kindness to us. This is the Redeemer who brings us into his family. And it is by faith in this Redeemer that we are saved. Let's pray.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. Please rate and review us on your podcast service and share with anyone who may be interested. The intro and outro music for the New Life podcast is provided by Sandra McCracken with her permission. Please visit her website at sandramccracken.com. We'll see you next week.